This document outlines New Zealand's strategy for artificial intelligence, focusing on accelerating private sector adoption rather than foundational development to drive local economic growth.
Right. And it actually makes a really strong case for that core premise, you know, being a small economy and all.
Yeah, it definitely does. But let's just dive straight into the feedback. The strategy's emphasis on overcoming barriers for small and medium enterprises is heavily undermined by proposed solutions and case studies that cater predominantly to well-funded, advanced tech sectors.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the text explicitly identifies a massive barrier right near the beginning, right? Like 68% of SMEs have absolutely no plans to evaluate or invest in AI.
Which is a huge chunk of the market.
Exactly. And the material correctly diagnoses the root of the problem. It notes that everyday businesses just, well, they lack a fundamental understanding of its value and how it applies to their daily operations.
Yeah, but then to solve that hesitation, they point to what? Halter?
Right, Halter, which they proudly note is a $1 billion agritech unicorn. And they highlight Formis Labs doing, you know, world-first 3D surgical planners.
Oh, and Alliometry with the wearable gut monitoring devices?
Yes. Like, these are phenomenal, world-class achievements. But they represent the absolute apex of deep tech R&D. They do not represent everyday commercial adoption.
Look, I can certainly see the disconnect there. But let me just challenge that framing for a second.
Sure, go for it.
Well, if the government's broader mandate here is to project strength, right? To attract foreign venture capital and brand New Zealand as this highly sophisticated digital economy, don't they kind of have to showcase the absolute best of the best?
Because if you draft the national strategy and fill up with examples of a local bakery using a chatbot to write marketing emails, doesn't that severely diminish the perceived sophistication of the country on a global stage?
I mean, that is a highly valid marketing perspective. If your target audience is purely, you know, Silicon Valley VCs looking for the next unicorn, but we have to look at the stated objective of the document itself.
Right, which is broad economic uplift. Exactly. Broad domestic economic uplift through widespread adoption. You cannot achieve macroeconomic uplift if the middle tier of your economy, which makes up the vast majority of employers in New Zealand, feels entirely alienated by the policy.
Yeah, I guess when a regional construction firm reads about measuring gastric electrical activity, they aren't exactly inspired to buy new software.
The mechanism of failure here is alienation. They look at that case study and subconsciously conclude AI is for scientists with massive capital backing, not for my supply chain bottlenecks. It reinforces the exact barrier they're trying to dismantle.
So it feels a bit like we're building a multi-billion dollar superhighway, but we forgot to pave the on-ramps for regular cars.
That is the perfect analogy. And the structural solutions proposed in the text suffer from this exact same altitude problem.
You mean the capability building mechanisms?
Precisely. The document leans heavily on two major pillars, the 15% research and development tax incentive and advanced Master of AI degrees being offered at Victoria University.
Wow, okay. Yeah.
Think about the operational reality of that 68% demographic. If I run a 20-person manufacturing firm, I'm managing tight payrolls, right? I'm fighting inflationary supply costs.
You definitely do not have the free cash flow to sink hundreds of thousands of dollars into high-risk R&D.
Right, just to claim a 15% tax credit at the end of the following year. Nor am I pulling my floor manager off the line to go get a specialized master's degree in machine learning.
So the solutions are totally inaccessible to a standard small business owner who's just, you know, trying to survive a tight economic cycle.
Exactly. They've engineered a brilliant solution for the top 1% of the market, while leaving the rest of the economy entirely stranded.
Okay, so to transition this into actionable advice, the suggestion here is clearly to align the real-world examples and immediate capability-building actions directly with the everyday operational realities of the SMEs the strategy desperately wants to reach.
Yes. You have to hold up a mirror that they can actually recognize themselves in. Lower that perceived barrier to entry from, you know, world-first medical breakthrough down to immediate operational efficiency.
So what are some concrete ways the author can actually implement this shift in the next draft?
First, just swap out at least one or two of those deep tech case studies for highly relatable examples of traditional, non-tech New Zealand businesses.
Like a local retail chain or an independent trade business?
Exactly. Show a mid-sized agriculture supplier using highly accessible off-the-shelf generative AI. Break down the mechanics of how they used it. Maybe they optimized their seasonal inventory forecasting or automated supplier communications across time zones.
Just proving an immediate, low-cost return on investment.
Right. You want the reader to think, oh, I deal with that exact same inventory problem every single month, and I had no idea the software to fix it was that cheap and easy to deploy?
It totally shifts the narrative from AI being an abstract science project to AI just being a basic utility, like broadband.
Exactly. And building on that, we really need to look at the capability building section. The document currently has this brief mention of utilizing the Regional Business Partner Network and Business Mentors New Zealand.
To upskill advisors, right?
Yeah, which is a solid foundation, but to make it a functional strategy, they need to detail exactly what a micro-adoption pathway looks like for a five-person company. Don't just point to the $611 million spent on heavy R&D.
So outline a specific low-barrier entry point. Like what, specifically?
Well, they could propose a concrete digital voucher scheme or a standardized low-cost diagnostic tool delivered directly through that regional business partner network.
Oh, I like that.
Show the reader the exact stepping stones from zero knowledge to an initial consultation to confident baseline adoption. Make the on-ramp visible, affordable, and practically effortless.
Okay, but if we actually succeed in getting every regional supplier and local clinic to integrate AI off those micro-adoption pathways, that suddenly creates a massive, unprecedented data vacuum across the domestic economy.
It really does.
Which brings us to the next point. The document's reliance on existing light-touch regulatory frameworks creates a noticeable tension when paired with the acute, novel risks identified regarding indigenous cultural intellectual property.
Yeah, the contradiction between different sections of this text is just severe. Section 5 confidently asserts that New Zealand's existing technology-neutral laws, like the Privacy Acts and Consumer Protection, are largely sufficient.
And they frame that light-touch approach as a deliberate competitive advantage, right, to enable rapid innovation.
Exactly. It leans heavily on the OECD AI principles as this overarching framework, suggesting the country will simply follow international norms as they eventually settle down.
But then we hit case study 2, which focuses heavily on Maori communities and Maturanga Maori, representing indigenous data and traditional knowledge.
Right, and that case study actively undercuts the confidence of Section 5. The text points out that Maori communities face immense, unprecedented risks of cultural misappropriation and a total loss of data sovereignty.
Because large AI models just scrape cultural knowledge and language without consent.
Exactly. So the weakness here is a total failure of strategic logic. The document admits that international norms are only just being formed through complex litigation overseas and states that New Zealand will just actively monitor these developments.
Wait, let me push back on this because I think there's a pretty strong geopolitical argument for why the author did this. Are we sure relying on the OECD isn't just the smartest, most pragmatic play here?
How so?
Well, if we rely entirely on international frameworks that are still being litigated, aren't we telling creators to just wait and see? But on the flip side, if New Zealand jumps the gun and drafts hyper-localized data laws, don't we risk locking our domestic tech sector out of global platforms?
I see what you mean. The compliance overhead.
Right. Big tech might look at a bespoke regulatory framework for a 5-million-person market and decide it's just not worth it. Is it waiting for the international dust to settle the most responsible economic move?
Look, there is a massive difference between strategic patience and regulatory negligence. Is there a risk of compliance overhead? Yes, but the mechanics of AI training models make the wait-and-see approach fundamentally flawed for cultural IP.
Because once it's in the system,
international foundation model scrapes indigenous data and ingests it into its weights and parameters. You cannot untrain that model. The sovereignty is permanently lost.
Right? It's just gone?
So if you have a vulnerable population facing an immediate, existential threat of data scraping right now, merely monitoring international discussions at the OECD leaves a massive gap that actively sanctions harm while you wait. You can't champion a light-touch policy if it inadvertently legalizes the strip mining of your unique cultural heritage.
That clarifies the severity immensely. So the suggestion here must be to reconcile the passive, light-touch regulatory stance with the proactive, urgent protections needed for indigenous data sovereignty.
Exactly. They must carve out a deliberate, proactive mechanism specifically for Maturanga Maori that does not wait for international courts to dictate the terms.
So how do we concretely fix that in the text without accidentally rewriting the entire National Privacy Act?
Well, one highly effective approach would be to introduce the concept of a localized indigenous data governance AI sandbox.
Oh, interesting. So rather than a permanent national law that might conflict with future OECD rulings, you're setting up a ring-fenced environment.
Precisely. A space where tech firms and Maori communities can co-design compliance and test AI applications using cultural data under bespoke temporary rules.
Which allows that rapid innovation they want, but actively shields the cultural IP in a protected space until international laws actually catch up?
Exactly. It completely shifts the government's role from a passive monitor to an active, localized facilitator.
And what about the existing agencies mentioned in the text? Like, can they be leveraged to solve this?
Yes. And that's the second concrete example for improvement. The document currently mentions that Te Puni Kokiri is, quote, exploring ways to support the appropriate use of AI with indigenous data.
Exploring ways is not exactly a strategy.
Right. It's a polite intention. The author needs to provide a concrete mandate and a firm timeline for this exploratory work. Anchor it to reality.
So state explicitly that by the end of 2025, they will release a binding framework for public sector procurement involving indigenous data models.
Exactly. By shifting the tone from passive observation to active, world-leading domestic policymaking, the strategy turns a perceived vulnerability into a unique global advantage.
Now, applying a strict, non-negotiable timeline to that indigenous data framework actually exposes a much larger structural vacuum in the rest of the text. The overarching vision for accelerating AI adoption lacks the quantifiable metrics and time-bound milestones necessary to function as a fully actionable strategic roadmap.
Oh, yeah. This is arguably the most critical structural flaw in the entire document. Now, the text is undeniably excellent at identifying the current state of play.
Right. It meticulously catalogs all the existing investments.
Exactly. The $1.2 billion flowing into the broader science system, the new Invest New Zealand entity, the $71 million advanced technology platform. It's a very thorough inventory of what is happening right now.
But an inventory of inputs isn't a strategy for outcomes.
Nailed it. The weakness is that the strategy operates almost entirely without specific government-owned targets. The only metric of future success provided anywhere in the text is a third-party estimate pulled from a Microsoft report.
The one suggesting generative AI could add $76 billion to the economy by 2038.
Yes, which is a massive, abstract, 14-year macroeconomic projection provided by a software vendor. It is not an intermediate key performance indicator that a government can actually use to manage a strategy year over year.
So a key theme running through this material seems to be setting the stage, but without a clock on the wall, it's hard to tell if we're moving fast enough. If we don't define what success looks like in 2026 or 2027, this reads more like an economic philosophy than a competitive strategy.
That is the exact mechanism of failure. Without a specific launch date or performance target for initiatives like the Public Service AI Work Program, international VC firms can't align their funding cycles with New Zealand's market.
Right, because capital goes where there is certainty and momentum. By leaving out timelines, this strategy is actively turning away the exact investment dollars it claims to be courting. Nobody knows when anything is supposed to happen.
Exactly. Investors and the public have absolutely no way to measure the momentum.
Let me play devil's advocate on setting hard KPIs for a technology moving this fast, though.
Sure.
If I'm drafting this strategy, maybe I intentionally avoid tying myself to a 30% adoption rate or a specific rollout date, because the underlying technology could look entirely different in 6 months.
Uh-huh.
Like, if OpenAI releases a new model tomorrow that completely changes hardware requirements, rigid KPIs become instantly obsolete. Doesn't maintaining a high-level philosophical approach actually protect the strategy from aging poorly?
I mean, that is a very common defense when drafting technology policy. But it fundamentally misinterprets what a strategic KPI is meant to do. Flexibility without metrics is just a lack of accountability.
Right. If you don't stick a claim on a number, nobody can technically fail.
But nobody really succeeds either. Metrics in a fast-moving environment act as tripwires. If you set a target to achieve a certain level of SME adoption by 2026, and a new global AI model entirely disrupts the market, you use that KPI to realize you are missing your target.
Which then triggers an immediate adjustment of your policy settings.
Exactly. Without the metric, you were just drifting blindly while the technology changes around you.
Okay, so the suggestion here must be to anchor the high-level policy goals and capability-building initiatives with firm, measurable targets. We have to transition the document from a statement of intent into a rigorous strategy.
Yes. So what are some concrete examples of the types of metrics they should weave into this final section?
Let's go right back to the beginning of our discussion. The document identifies that 68% of SMEs have no plans to adopt AI.
Right.
The strategy should commit to a specific, quantifiable goal based on that exact baseline data point. Explicitly state a target of reducing the SME non-adoption rate from 68% down to 30% by the end of 2028, which instantly gives the regional business partner network a highly specific mandate to execute against.
Yes, and it provides the government with a clear metric to judge the success of their voucher schemes, and it signals to the market that the government is actually serious about moving the needle.
It turns a passive statistic into an active finish line. What else?
Furthermore, the document announces the creation of a new Advanced Technology Public Research Organization, or PRO, but the text simply states it, quote, will be created.
So they need a date?
The strategy needs to establish a firm launch date for when this PRO will deliver its first commercial AI outreach program to the private sector. Give the market a timeline.
Like officially opening in Q3 of next year?
Exactly. If you tell international investors and local tech firms that, they can align their capital planning and hiring strategies with your roadmap. Without those dates and targets, the strategy is just hovering in midair, completely detached from the realities of corporate planning.
It all comes back to giving the participants on the ground a sense of scale, a sense of safety, and a sense of time.
Definitely.
Let's briefly recap the overarching feedback we've explored in this critique. The document provides a highly articulate, very pragmatic foundation for navigating the AI transition. It correctly identifies that adoption, rather than foundational development, is the key to economic uplift.
But it requires significant strategic tightening to truly activate its intended audience.
To maximize its real-world impact, the strategy must provide accessible, low-barrier examples and structural on-ramps for everyday SMEs, moving beyond just highlighting billion-dollar deep tech unicorns.
And it needs to reconcile its passive, light-touch regulatory approach with the urgent, proactive need to protect Mari cultural data by establishing bespoke sandbox environments.
And finally, it absolutely must implement rigorous, time-bound metrics to track its own progress, signal certainty to global investors, and hold the entire ecosystem accountable.
Absolutely.
We warmly invite the author to revise their strategy document, incorporating these critical lenses, and please submit your work back in again for another critique. We would love to see how this evolves.
It's going to be great to see.
A strategic blueprint is only as powerful as its connection to the people expected to build it. When you align your examples with the everyday reality of your businesses, actively protect the unique cultural assets of your communities, and clearly define the metrics of your success, you stop merely observing the future and start actively commanding it.